Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 3rd of May, these are our main stories. The warring parties in Sudan say they'll observe a 7-day truce from Thursday. Close to 500,000 Sudanese have fled their homes since fighting erupted more than 2 weeks ago. For the second time in as many days, a bomb blast has derailed a Russian train close to the Ukrainian border. Serbia and Kosovo have agreed to cooperate in locating and identifying hundreds of people still missing from their conflict towards the turn of the century. Also in the podcast, the Ukrainian farmer tackling Russian landmines with a remote-controlled tractor. And
we are taking brain scans of people and we are reading out the words that they are either hearing in a story or words that they're just thinking.
Turning people's thoughts into written text with the help of artificial intelligence. We begin in Sudan. The conflict there is now in its third week, and it doesn't seem like there's an end in sight, despite a series of ceasefire announcements. In the latest, the rival military forces say they've agreed to a 7-day truce from Thursday. Since the beginning of the fighting, hundreds of people have been killed, thousands wounded, and tens of thousands are trying to flee the country. I spoke to the BBC Sudan expert Mohamed Hashim, who's in Jeddah, a port city in Saudi Arabia, where many refugees have been arriving. So does he think there's any chance that this latest truce announcement will hold?
We live in hope. This is about the sixth ceasefire to be announced between the warring parties. None of the previous five that they have mentioned has been comprehensively observed. Just before coming on air, I was speaking to some people in Sudan who told me that today in Khartoum, there have been air raids and the gunfire is heard and explosions. So anybody's guess if they will honour this new ceasefire agreement that should come into effect in a couple of days' time.
We know the UN is warning of a humanitarian crisis. What's the situation on a humanitarian level there right now?
On a humanitarian level, I think we are experiencing a very difficult and bad situation, especially for the tens of thousands that are stranded along the Sudanese-Egyptian borders, be it in the Argin border crossing in the desert or the people who are in Halfa. You hear very horrible stories of elderly people who are sleeping rough in the streets, people who have comas, who have nowhere to go. You're hearing of people complaining that the Egyptian side is delaying the visa process and slowing it almost to a halt in places that don't have any facilities, really. No toilets, no shops, no food. So it is quite a bad situation for the people who are stranded in those places. Meanwhile, the fighting continues on in West Darfur, and you have tens of thousands have crossed into Chad to try and flee the violence in the city of Jenina, where more than 200 people have died in the past week. And on the other side, in Port Sudan, you have thousands who've made it to the port city on the Red Sea, hoping to either catch an evacuation ship or flight out of the country. But then there are thousands who are stranded. And these numbers are descending on towns and cities that don't have decent infrastructure to cope with the influx of people that is coming in. However, it appears that the Sudanese solidarity at the moment is showing its best face. You have neighborhood committees that are helping people who are opening their homes to receive people who are on the move, mosques that are being used as hotels for Muslims and non-Muslims to sleep while they find a way to move on forward, people coming out of their homes in villages along these long roads to offer people juice or food or shelter. So the Sudanese civil society and Sudanese communities across the country appear to be filling in the gap that is left with the absence of the international humanitarian organizations.
Mohamed Hashim. And yesterday on the Global News podcast, we heard from the man widely regarded as the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, who resigned from his job at Google and warned people about the dangers of AI. He also said he regretted large parts of his life's work. It's well worth downloading that episode. Some experts, though, are concerned about the rate that AI is advancing. Others, however, are taking a more positive view. The BBC's Mark Easton has been considering both sides of the argument.
The Dutch chess grandmaster Jan Hein Donner was once asked how he'd prepare for a chess match against artificial intelligence. His reply, "I would bring a hammer." From Frankenstein to Terminator, the fear that AI might destroy human society has been a mainstay of science fiction for centuries, playing on the same dread of rapid technological change which accompanied the arrival of the printing press, spinning jenny, steam engines and smartphones. That AI will change society is beyond question. Millions of existing jobs in manufacturing, transport and public administration will disappear. But it's expected that millions more will be created in healthcare, education, science and the arts. The drudgery of repetitive tasks will be replaced by work involving creativity and empathy, occupations that may well give people greater satisfaction and personal fulfillment. There are significant risks, ethical and moral boundaries that will need to be policed, particularly around data and privacy. But the relief one feels when the online AI chatbot hands over to a real human being suggests that artificial intelligence may encourage a world where people are more social and pursue greater emotional intelligence. Paradoxically, robots may make us better humans.
Well, let's stay with artificial intelligence now. Researchers at the University of Texas in the US have invented a way of translating someone's thoughts into written text. They use what they call a semantic decoder to depict brain activity in words and sentences. The hope is that they can eventually be used to give a voice to mentally conscious people who are unable to speak, for example, after a stroke. But there could be lots of other uses too. Alexander Huth is assistant professor of neuroscience in Austin, Texas, and co-author of the research.
We are taking brain scans of people, and we are reading out the words that they are either hearing in a story or words that they're just thinking. We're using functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. It's a lot like a normal MRI, but it uses just a slightly different sequence that can capture blood flow in different parts of your brain.
And how does the artificial intelligence come in?
It comes in on two sides. First, we use an artificial intelligence model, GPT. It's the predecessor to ChatGPT and GPT-4. To actually model how the human brain responds to language. We kind of convert stories that somebody is listening to into sequences of numbers that capture sort of language and meaning in those stories. And then we build these models that predict how the brain responds based on those numbers. And then in part two, we use these same models to kind of guess words that we think the person might have heard. And then we can use the model that we fit in the first part to check if those guesses are correct.
Is there a way of checking how accurate it is?
Of course, yeah. So for a lot of our experiment, we just have people listen to stories, and then we try to decode from their brain activity what were the words of the story that they were listening to. So for that, we can compare to the actual story that they heard. That's easy. For the experiment where we had people thinking things, that was obviously a bit more difficult. So what we did there is we actually had our subjects learn little one-minute segments of stories and practice telling them over and over again until they could tell them in a sort of consistent time frame. Then we recorded them telling this little story, immediately put them in the scanner, and then had them do the exact same thing, but just not speak out loud. So then we could compare the words that actually were decoded during that time to the story that they had recorded before they went in the scanner.
Now, it doesn't take much imagination to know that there's a lot of potential in this process of turning people's thoughts into text. How first do you want it to be used?
We really want this to help people. Right? There are a lot of people who, for various medical reasons, are unable to communicate. And we think that this kind of technology, maybe not using fMRI specifically, could be very helpful for those people. But we definitely acknowledge that there is the potential for misuse here. We took that really seriously in our work, and we tested a few different privacy implications. So we showed, for example, that it takes a lot of training data to kind of fit this model to one person. It takes about 16 hours of somebody being in an MRI scanner. So we asked, can we just put a new person in the scanner and decode from their brain without all this training time? Can we take the model we learned from one person and map it to another one? And the answer to that was definitely not. We also showed that the person who you're decoding from, they have a great deal of control over what's being decoded. So if they think thoughts that are just about other things, if they try to, for example, name as many animals as they can in their head, they can totally disrupt the functioning of this.
Right. But you can imagine an authoritarian regime wanting to get their hands on this method of interrogating political prisoners, absolutely, can't you?
Sure, that's true. We think that it's actually very important to enshrine, for example, protections for mental privacy in law. I think we don't want this kind of thing to be used for law enforcement purposes, certainly, or, for example, by employers. This won't necessarily stop authoritarian regimes, but I think we need to have this conversation now before it becomes an actual problem. If we educate people about what this can and can't do, then I think that can go a long way to preventing at least some of the immediate harms. So we always point to the example of the polygraph, the lie detector, which is fundamentally pseudoscience. It doesn't really work, but because people believe that it works, it can coerce them into confessing to things, for example. We don't want that situation to be sort of repeated here. So we want to be very clear about the fact that this is not a lie detector. This can't tell if you're lying or not. This can't read your memories. All it can read is kind of the words that you are actively thinking in your head.
Alexander Huth with that research, speaking to Paul Henley. There's been a train derailment in an area of Russia bordering Ukraine for the second time in as many days. A statement on Tuesday evening said a locomotive and 20 freight carriages had left the track in the Bryansk region. Sasha Schlichter reports.
Just like Monday's derailment, which was much closer to the border, the official reason given was an explosive device on the tracks. Such an admission is extremely rare. Moscow is loath to point a finger at Ukrainian saboteurs or even Russian partisans. Kyiv, for its part, observes a policy of ambiguity, sometimes joking that the locals were probably smoking in the wrong place.
In Ukraine itself, large parts of the country are riddled with landmines planted by the Russians during the invasion. Vladimir Putin's forces were driven back last year from parts of eastern Ukraine, and now farmers have been struggling to sow the land there. But one has found a novel way to deal with the problem. More from the BBC's Andrew Ocheng.
The Pat tractor, Pat post-apocalyptic contraption, lumbers across a huge field in the Kharkiv region of eastern Ukraine. It was designed by Oleksandr Krestov, a farmer in the village of Krakove, to clear the land of mines, after deciding he couldn't wait for help from overworked official demining teams.
We started doing this just because the crop sowing time has come, and we can't do anything because the rescue services are very busy.
It can withstand blasts because it's filled with panels stripped from Russian tanks. It's also operated remotely by a man in the raised bucket of a digger nearby. Alexander says they have reasons to be careful.
We ran over an anti-tank mine. The protection got blown out. The tractor is safe. The mechanics weren't here. Everyone's alive and safe. The equipment was restored and repaired.
Ukraine estimates that about 30% of its territory has been mined by Russians during the invasion, but says it's been focused on demining agricultural land as soon as possible. It's a huge challenge. The head of the unit overseeing the tractor's work says it would take years to demine this field by hand and guarantee there are no mines in it.
Andrew Ocheng with that report. Still to come.
We don't have equipment and trained staff. There is nothing we can do but watch babies dying.
We hear about the shocking state of public health in Afghanistan as the UN Secretary General talks of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The Global Jigsaw is the new podcast from BBC Monitoring, the BBC team tracking and analysing media in 100 languages. We're lifting the language barrier, showing you the world through the eyes of its media, where conflicting narratives are competing to influence your views. Search for the Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Thanks for staying with us. This is the Global News Podcast with Chris Barrow. Now, after a decade of negotiations, it looks like the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo have reached an agreement on people who went missing during the Kosovo War in the 1990s. More than 1,600 people are still listed as missing or unidentified. The deal came out of normalisation talks taking place in Brussels and backed by the European Union. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay gave us the details.
This has been an issue which has been causing a lot of distress between Kosovo and Serbia for very many years. And now the two sides have agreed a joint declaration. And this joint declaration isn't wishy-washy. It's quite detailed. And Serbia and Kosovo have agreed to set up a joint commission chaired by the European Union with consultation from the International Committee for the Red Cross to sort out this missing persons issue. They're going to pool their resources. They're going to be using technology such as satellite imagery and LIDAR And also, they're going to be exchanging official documents from the late 1990s, the time of the Kosovo conflict, in an effort to find these missing persons and identify them. And the EU says there is still about 1,600 people who haven't been found, haven't been identified from that conflict.
And what was the reason for the breakthrough? How did we get here?
Well, we've been negotiating for years. We've had normalisation talks going on for an awfully long time between Serbia and Kosovo. And we thought we had a very significant agreement 10 years ago with what was called the Brussels Agreement, elements of which still haven't been implemented, much to the chagrin of the two sides. What we had 2 months ago was an announcement by the European Union, by Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, that the two sides had made a deal, and that this was it, basically, Mr. Borrell was saying. Then, of course, the two leaders came out separately, and it was pretty clear that there wasn't actually a firm agreement in place, and they were disagreeing on what had actually been agreed. So I think what we're seeing now is quite a long process of meetings between Serbia and Kosovo to thrash out the detail of this rather broad picture that was verbally agreed in March. And to get this joint declaration on missing persons agreed, published and disseminated, I think shows that there's at least some, I mean, it's one hesitates to say this when Serbia and Kosovo are involved, but it seems there is some degree of goodwill between the two sides on that issue. And of course, the European Union will be hoping that that spreads to other elements of this agreement they made or perhaps didn't quite make in March.
Guy Delaunay. The United Nations will stay in Afghanistan and continue to deliver aid to millions of Afghans, despite the ruling Taliban's decision to restrict women from working with NGOs and UN agencies. That was the outcome of a two-day meeting convened by the UN Secretary-General in Doha with special envoys from several countries. Antonio Guterres said the situation in Afghanistan was extremely serious.
It is difficult to overestimate the gravity of the situation in Afghanistan. It is the largest humanitarian crisis in the world today. 97% of Afghans live in poverty. Two-thirds of the population, 28 million, will need humanitarian assistance this year to survive. 6 million Afghan children, women and men, are one step away from famine-like conditions. And meanwhile, funding is evaporating.
He added that the Taliban's exclusion of women and girls was a serious violation of human rights. Two-thirds of Afghans don't know where their next meal will come from, and an estimated 167 children under the age of 5 die every day from preventable diseases, that's according to UNICEF. Public health infrastructure that was weak before the Taliban took over and foreign funding was frozen is virtually broken now. And the little that's being supported by aid agencies could also be under threat because of the Taliban's policies. From the western province of Gore, the BBC's Yogita Lebeye looks at what this would mean for Afghanistan's children. And a warning, you may find some of this report distressing.
We've just stepped out of one of the rooms that's full of little children. We'd gone in earlier and the doctor had pointed out one baby in the corner who was suffering from pneumonia, severe acute malnutrition and hepatitis. And as we were looking at the child, the baby didn't appear to be breathing. The doctor called in nurses. They came in with oxygen masks and at this moment they are trying to revive the baby.
The baby's name is Tayadullah. He's 3 months old. A nurse uses an oxygen pump to try to get him to breathe. They've heard a faint heartbeat through the stethoscope. A doctor uses his thumbs to perform compressions on Tayadullah's tiny chest. The sudden silence that has enveloped the room is broken by the sound of his mother, Nigar, crying as she realizes her son is fading. His grandfather, Gausaddin, looks stricken. It took them 8 hours on rubble roads to carry Tayadullah here. A family that can barely afford to eat scraped together money to make the journey. After half an hour of trying, the family is told Tayadullah has died. Nurse Edima Sultani had tried to save Tayadullah with whatever little they have in the hospital, but was defeated by a lack of resources.
I'm also a mother, and when I saw the baby die, I felt like I've lost my own child. When I saw his mother sobbing, it broke my heart. It hurt my conscience. We don't have equipment and trained staff. There is nothing we can do but watch babies die.
Barely a few moments pass before we find another child in severe distress in the room next door. 2-year-old Gulbadan is struggling to breathe despite the oxygen mask strapped to her face. She has a heart defect diagnosed 6 months ago at this hospital, but it's not equipped to treat her. So the family took her to Kabul, her grandmother Afwa Gul told us.
We borrowed money to take her there, but we couldn't afford surgery in Kabul, so we had to bring her back. Please help us cure her.
What Gulbadan has is not uncommon or hard to treat. It could have been fixed with a routine operation. She'd just begun to speak, forming her first words, calling out to her family. Her father, Nawroz, strokes her forehead, wanting to soothe his child, forced to helplessly watch as she suffers.
If I had an income, she would have never suffered this way. Right now, I don't even have the money to buy a cup of tea. This hospital doesn't have any equipment to cure her. You can barely find an oxygen cylinder.
I asked Dr. Ahmed Samadi, who was in the room, about oxygen.
How much oxygen does the patient require right now?
The child needs 2 liters of oxygen per minute. And if we run out of oxygen, she will die.
When we came back later, we were told that's exactly what happened. Gulbadan died because oxygen ran out. Within hours, 2 children died. Another crushing blow for Dr. Samadi, who runs the pediatric ward.
I feel exhaustion and agony. Every day, we lose 1 or 2 beloved children of Ghor. We're almost accustomed to it now. We need equipment, ventilators and monitors. We need oxygen and medicines.
The salaries of doctors and nurses at this hospital, the cost of medicines and food, are currently being funded by humanitarian agencies. Even with the support, it is clear that that is sorely insufficient on the ground. And the idea that that funding could be at risk now, because aid agencies are warning that donors might cut the money that they're giving to them because of the Taliban's policies. If that cut in funding happens, in places like this, it would be catastrophic.
Yogurt Alimoye with that report. Now, here in Britain, the spiritual leader of the Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has defended plans for the public to be invited to swear allegiance to King Charles during his coronation at the weekend. The plans have caused some controversy since they were announced on Saturday and also prompted speculation of a rift between the Archbishop and Buckingham Palace. Our religion editor, Ali McBull, has been speaking to the Archbishop, Justin Welby.
Since more details about the coronation service were released, it is what's described as the homage of the people that's been the biggest talking point. The idea of the viewing public swearing allegiance to the king and his heirs and successors during the service led to a backlash on social media. That in turn prompted a clarification from the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury to say people were not being expected or even requested to swear allegiance. And the Archbishop himself, Justin Welby, denied he'd unilaterally introduced the idea of this public pledge of allegiance or that there had been any rift with Buckingham Palace over it, in spite of newspaper reports to the contrary.
This is just a way of saying to anyone who wants to, it's an invitation, it's not a command. There's no drama to it.
It's being written up as you going rogue.
No, there's no individual who can claim the credit for this service. It's been a huge collaborative and a very lovely process, actually.
Swearing allegiance to an individual is something that jars with a lot of people.
Well, then they don't have to do it.
The Archbishop of Canterbury said it was mainly intended as a means by which people around the country could participate, and that none of the fallout has put him off the idea.
Ali McBull. Major public broadcasters in five European countries could be denied the rights to broadcast the Women's World Cup because they aren't offering enough money to show the games. The head of football's world governing body FIFA, Gianni Infantino, says he wants to see higher bids ahead of the tournament, which starts in Australia and New Zealand in July. He singled out broadcasters in the UK, Spain, Italy, Germany and France.
Broadcasters, especially public broadcasters, funded by taxpayers' money, should put their action behind their words, because they rightfully criticise football organisations or other sports organisations for not paying equally women and men or not having the same prize money. Well, we need to generate these revenues, and they should help us, because otherwise we'll simply not sell these rights at these undervalued prices to them. Mm-hmm. And, well, the European public will not be able to watch the Women's World Cup, which after the success of the last tournament in France, after the success of the Euro, would be really, really a pity.
Strong words from Gianni Infantino there. Well, I got more from our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
This is not the first time Gianni Infantino has complained about the lack of money coming from broadcasters in those countries that you mentioned. He said that broadcasters had offered between $1 and $10 million US dollars for the rights, and that's compared with 100 to 200 million
oh, wow.
for the men's World Cup. So there is a huge difference, and if that's true, you can understand why he is upset about this. He said that this amounted to a slap in the face for the players and to all women worldwide, and that it was his moral and legal obligation not to undersell the tournament, and this threat that he'll be forced not to broadcast the Women's World Cup in those five countries unless those broadcasters increase their offers. The way that it's been done this time is a first for the Women's World Cup, because previously the broadcast deals have been wrapped up with the men's tournament, but they've separated it out now. So this is the first time they've done it, and they expect it to generate money, because what FIFA want to do, or what they have done for this tournament coming up in Australia and New Zealand, is they've increased the prize money. They've trebled it to $152 million, but it's much less still than the men's got in Qatar last year. But he wants the women to reach parity by the next World Cups in 26 and 27. But in order to do that, he's called on the broadcasters to step up.
Viewership is pretty good, though, from recent history. So why would broadcasters offer less money? Is it because less advertising or less interest? What's the reason?
Partly because of where it is. Certainly in Europe, it's happening in Australia and New Zealand. So the times of the day that the matches are going to be played is outside prime time viewing in European countries. So those games will kick off in the early hours of the morning up until midday. But Gianni Infantino said he understands that, but that's not a good reason. It's not an excuse. And he talks about the growing interest in the women's game. 1.2 billion viewers, according to FIFA, tuned in to the last Women's World Cup. That was in France 4 years ago. There's a global audience of 365 million for the Women's Euros, which was hosted by England and won by England last year. So he doesn't think that's a good enough reason.
Alex Capstick there. And finally, a brief return to the subject of seagulls here on the Global News podcast, and just exactly how we respond to them. Now, last month we told you about an annual seagull imitation contest held in the Belgian coastal town of De Pan. Here's a quick reminder of some of those entrants. Very impressive. In contrast, Blackpool Zoo in the northwest of England is recruiting human seagull deterrents, whose job will be to scare the gulls away. There the gulls take food from the resident animals as well as from human visitors. Evan Davis asked the manager, Ian Walker, if these new recruits will also be imitating birds.
Yes, that person is dressed up as an eagle. They will be asked to flap their wings, but they will be there to inform our visitors on the do's and don'ts.
It is more for the visitors than it is about the gulls, is that right?
It's a bit of both. In the short time that we have given the eagle a run out with one of our members of staff, Jess, it's been working, to be fair.
I was struck by that Belgian town trying to help the gulls. Obviously, is there any way humans and gulls can live in harmony?
Yeah, I do believe they can. I mean, and again, I think that's why the educational part is so important. By feeding animals, by trying to detract them from coming towards us, by throwing food away or being aggressive, only has the opposite effect.
Ian Walker there. And sadly, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. May or may not contain seagulls, who knows? If you want to comment on the podcast, though, or some of the topics that we're covering, please do send us an email. Our address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter, that bird platform, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Alison Davies. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Chris Barrow. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.